Join the conversation.
Email pippa8@capetalk.co.za.
In Legal Talk today, we're taking a look at protection orders. What are they? Who can apply for one? In what circumstances? What does the application process entails? And what should one do if you have one, but it's being ignored? Those are some of the questions I'm going to put to our guest, who is Advocate Bronwyn Pithy of the Women's Legal Centre. Always a pleasure to have a member of your team on the show today, but particularly so during Women's Month. Bronwyn, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Pippa, and thanks for having us again.
Might sound like an obvious question, but can you start by telling us what a protection order actually is? What is it intended to do?
Sure. No, and I don't think it's an obvious question at all, because I think a lot of people get quite confused with terminology and the kind of various options that are available to people. So a protection order essentially is what we call a civil remedy as opposed to a criminal remedy. And maybe we can chat a little bit about that, that women have an option. I'm going to use women generally as complainants, that they do have an option of pursuing both a civil and criminal remedy. But in terms of a protection order, it's a civil remedy, which really means that there are not necessarily immediately any criminal consequences attached to obtaining a protection order against a respondent. So really what it is, it's what people used to kind of know as an interdict, although we still do have interdicts, but in this context, we call them protection orders. Okay. And really what they are is exactly what they say, in the sense that they are put in place to protect a person from further or ongoing abuse of a number of types of abuse. And you know, the nature of the abuse is very, very wide-reaching. So it really is a court order. It's a court order, effectively, that says you must or must not do X, Y, and Z in terms of pursuing, obviously, the furtherance of them protecting the person who has applied for the protection order. And that protection order, like I said, is a court order, which means that if it's broken, there's a contempt of court. And it also means that the police have the right to enforce that order, whatever the contents of that order say.
And you would actually start at the police station as your first step in the process of getting one, wouldn't you?
No, not actually necessarily. Not. Because it's a civil remedy, you can actually approach the courts directly without even going to the police station.
Okay.
But very often a lot of people will go to the police station first, because that is most often their best port of call in terms of getting advice. And very often, obviously, the courts are not available after hours. Although one can apply for a protection order if it is urgent, and there's certain criteria that one can apply for a protection order after hours, and that's going to be made a lot more easy when the new amendments to the Act come into place. But no, you don't have to approach the police. What you really are approaching the police to do, and this is very important, because very often, unfortunately, the police will turn people away and say, no, you must go to court to get assistance. The police are there to receive criminal complaints, and they are obliged in terms of the domestic violence legislation to provide all of those options to complainants who come in with a domestic violence complaint. So they can open a criminal case as well as be advised, and the police are under a legal obligation to advise them, fully advise them of all of their rights, which includes approaching the magistrate's court for a protection order. So it's not an either or, it's an and or.
Okay, thank you for clarifying that, because the first question already in from one of our listeners is whether the civil and criminal have to go hand in hand. So if you are applying for a protection order, is it necessary to also bring a criminal charge of domestic violence against the accused?
No, the short answer is no. And I think it's very important that people know that. Look, the reality is that a lot of complainants, a lot of women do not necessarily want their abuser or the person who's perpetrating some type of violence necessarily to have criminal charges laid against him. In other words, of assault or whatever the violence may constitute, the domestic violence may constitute. So that's why really this legislation came into effect so many years ago in the 90s, was to provide an alternative remedy to protect women, in other words, for the abuse to stop, but not necessarily to criminalize the perpetrator. So the perpetrator doesn't necessarily get a criminal conviction and does not go potentially to jail. The issue is that, it's like I said just now, it's not an either or. They can go hand in hand, and very often we advise in certain cases to lay a criminal charge at the same time. So then there will be an investigation around the criminal charge as well as obtaining a civil remedy, the protection order, through the courts. And yeah, just to add to that, where it can get a little bit confusing is when you have a protection order, say for argument's sake, you haven't actually laid criminal charges, but you have a protection order and there is a breach of that protection order by the abuser, that then constitutes a criminal offense in and of itself in the form of a contempt of court. And that's where it kind of slips into the criminal aspect of domestic violence protection order aspect.
That's really important to clarify. Thank you. Just for those who might have joined us late to the conversation, my guest is Advocate Bronwyn Pithy of the Women's Legal Centre, talking to us about the ins and outs of protection orders today. If you have questions, you're very welcome to call us on 021-446-0567 or to send an SMS to 31567 and a voice note to 072-567-1567. Bronwyn, so you've gone to the court, you've applied for a protection order, and you have received it. What is every order going to be different in terms of what it specifies and protects against? Can you give us a sense of what such a document might set out?
Yeah, sure. So look, first of all, one has to be in a domestic relationship, and that is very clearly defined. And at the moment, I'm kind of straddling two situations here because, as you're well aware, there's been quite extensive amendments to the domestic violence legislation, which are only going to come into effect in about November because they're quite far reaching, and there has been an administrative process whereby regulations are in the process of being drawn up to support all those amendments.
Okay.
So, the new amendments are a little bit broader than what we have. They've improved the act, but basically in terms of the fundamentals, one first of all has to be in a domestic relationship. And a domestic relationship is defined, you know, it's basically if one is related, if one lives together, if there has been a relationship, if there's been a previous relationship between people, there must be some kind of connection. And just to emphasize that if there is no connection between you, that doesn't mean that's the end of the road, because there's another piece of legislation, a Protection from Harassment Act, which you can then fall back on. But in terms of domestic violence, you first got to be in a domestic relationship to qualify for a protection order. Then secondly, an act of domestic violence must have been perpetrated, and that is very broad. So it includes both physical, sexual, emotional, and verbal, psychological abuse, economic abuse. We've now got included coercive behavior. Yeah. There's harassment, stalking, damage to property, all of those things. It's very broad. And that's really encouraging. So what the person then does is approaches the court, spells it out in what we call an affidavit, so which is a statement, which is a sworn statement, which will be assisted by the clerks of the court. And then the magistrate will consider the facts before them. It's important that at this stage, it's what we call an ex parte, which is just Latin for it's only one person who is applying, one party of the two people who are involved, who are applying for it. And because of the nature of very much often the urgency and the harm that is pending or has already been perpetrated, the magistrate will consider the facts before him or her and issue what we call an interim protection order. And that interim protection order is in place until the magistrate can hear from the other party as well, and what is what we call is it's postponed to a return day. So if there is enough evidence to show what we call prima facie evidence, which is on the face of it, shows that domestic violence has been perpetrated and that the person who made the application is in danger and that there is harm and pending harm that will be perpetrated against them, they then will get an interim protection order. That interim protection order will be served on the respondent by the police. And once it's served on the respondent, that order is in place until the return day, and that person the order has been made against has the opportunity to come to court to argue why the order, for argument's sake, shouldn't be made permanent.
Right.
And if it is made permanent, then it's permanent forever. I mean, that's also a very important thing to know, that it's in place as a legal, as a court order, indefinitely. There is no time frame on it.
It doesn't lapse. Okay, that's really important to know as well. In that interim period between the granting of an interim order and that return date for the other party to have their say, can they be, for example, banned from the house? If you share a home together, can a protection order tell that person you're not allowed to come home?
Absolutely. So sorry, that actually is what you asked me right at the beginning there. So basically each protection order is going to address the issues that are raised by the complainant or by the applicant. And the powers of the court are actually very far reaching. They can order virtually any kind of protective mechanisms to be put in place. So they can actually order evictions. Now, that often gets very tricky because, you know, in terms of ownerships of houses and things like that, yeah. and then custody of children. So very often the police have to do more investigations. Very often the courts will ask for a report even from the family advocates in terms of children. But yes, the court does have the authority or the power to even order someone to be evicted for a period of time until the final order is made. And then when the final order is made, the eviction can actually be made then as well. And I mean, those are very important because it's you know, in addition to things like that, you can also have orders that prevent people from coming within X amount of kilometers, yeah. of not approaching a school, of not approaching a workplace is very, very important for a lot of women.
Yeah.
A lot of abusers will approach women at their workplaces. It can, you know, instruct, a protection order can instruct no communications. It's very wide ranging. And of course, my caveat all the time is it's only as effective as the implementation of that order at the end of the day. It can only be worth the paper it's written on if it's properly implemented.
Right. Before we talk about that aspect further, Bronwyn, somebody asking on the SMS line, is it possible to take out a protection order against somebody who's only 16 years old?
Yeah. So basically, you can take orders out against children as well. That is possible. There's no prohibition against it. But that person will have to be represented because they're under the age of 18. They would have to have a parent or guardian represent them, and it would have to be held in camera. So all of the protections for a potential respondent or an abuser would have to be in place in order to protect their rights as a child.
Okay.
So yes, you can get an order against a child, but obviously there would have to be quite a lot of protective mechanisms in place to ensure that that child's rights are also protected in terms of the various pieces of legislation we have to protect children.
Yeah, okay. Speaking of representation, does one need legal representation to go through this process, or can it be done on your own with the help of the clerks of the court?
No, that's the beauty of this in many, many ways, is that you don't need legal representation. First of all, I do just want to say that there are some phenomenal organizations such as Mosaic and Anita Levantu just in the Western Cape,
yep.
that provide on-site services in some of the courts, in quite a lot of the courts, okay. in fact, in the Western Cape. And those people work together, they're called court supporters, and those people work together with the clerks of the court. So you can approach the court, you'll get services from those organizations as well as the clerks of the court. You are entitled to legal representation. You don't have to have it, but you're not excluded from having it. And one of the other issues that I think is very important to raise is that if the respondent or the perpetrator, the abuser, at the time of the return day where he may come to argue that, you know, the order shouldn't be made final, that he is represented, then women may approach legal aid. And if they qualify in terms of the legal aid requirements, they are entitled to legal representation from legal aid. So that's a very important differential to make. And in terms of the new, when the new provisions come into operation in November, legal aid is undertaken to provide that service to women.
Fantastic. Final question then is the big one that you've mentioned, Bronwyn. It's only as good as the paper it's written on if it's not implemented.
Yeah.
In your experience, do they work? Are they generally well enforced?
Yeah. You see, so I think that, again, you know, we work very closely with the police in a lot of ways, but really it is up to the police to enforce. First of all, we have to have the courts that are operating properly in terms of actually hearing these protection order applications as soon as possible and processing them and getting return days as soon as possible. So
yeah.
that's an administrative justice aspect. But very, very, probably the most important aspect of this is the police. That when women phone or when women go back to police stations and saying the order is being breached, the police absolutely have to act on them. And I can say in our experience is that unfortunately it's very inconsistent. You'll have some police stations who are fantastic, who are really taking this seriously. Unfortunately, there are still too many police officers and police areas that still kind of put this down to it's a domestic issue and we're not getting involved and they don't actually come in and protect. I'm hoping that with the new legislation and with a really raised awareness of the levels of violence and domestic violence in the country, that there will be a lot of pressure on the police to really start enforcing these protection orders and the warrants of arrest that go out that are accompanying protection orders.
Advocate Bronwyn Pithy, thank you as always for giving us such a broad and easy to follow understanding of a protection order. Really appreciate your time this afternoon.